I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody... No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
Yeah. It might not be appropriate, but get used to it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
A little.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI, in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. Out in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM, in Palinville, New York on 102.9 FM WLPP. In Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're also heard streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week on those fine affiliates and many others. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com, says me. Thank you for joining us today for what will undoubtedly be another thrilling action-packed adventure that we call America 2016. Whether we like it or not.
Actually, America 2017.
Oh, damn. See, already. And I had
you just want to go back in time to the good old days.
Maybe I do. I don't know. I already have a correction that I was going to do at the top of the show, but now you've topped that. I already have a correction before then. So you're right. 2017. Don't be alarmed. Or maybe you should be. That voice you heard was Desi Doyen, our producer. Also my co-host on the Green News Report, which we have one of which... coming up soon.
Ooh, grammar.
A little bit later in the program. Concerning a whole bunch of stuff, President Obama's appeal to reason on climate in his farewell address. And, of course, ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson and the grilling that he got concerning climate change during his Senate confirmation hearings, and much more in our Green News Report today. But and maybe we'll have some more thoughts later on Rex Tillerson. But something's going on, Desi Doyen, with Tillerson's nomination. He was supposed to have a second day of confirmation hearings on Thursday.
Right.
Those were canceled.
Yep.
Do we know why?
No official word on anything yet. So, no, there's lots of speculation about what might be going on. One of those speculations being that, oh, he did so badly, and Republicans who are Russia hawks are so not interested in anyone who has good relationships with Russia that maybe that's why they pulled him to retool so he'll do better in his next day. I guess, maybe, but we don't know.
Marco Rubio was said to be unhappy that Tillerson wouldn't declare Vladimir Putin a war criminal in this hearing.
Yes.
And that could be why there's this seeming hold at this point. The panel that he spoke before the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations is comprised of 11 Republicans and 10 Democrats. And so it would just take one, like Rubio, who, by the way, has a good reason to want to get back at Donald Trump. If Rubio votes against Tillerson, that would be enough to kill Tillerson's appointment, at least in committee. They can work around that. They can bring it to the full floor
of the Senate.
But that could be why, because it's 11 Republicans, 10 Democrats. If they lose one Republican, that's it. He will be rejected in that committee. So and I've had some other thoughts on Tillerson that, believe it or not, he may be the best option for Secretary of State under Donald
Trump.
Which
is a shocking thought.
That's how low the bar has gotten.
Well, and when you consider what the other options might be.
Exactly. But we don't have time for that now because we got a bunch to get to today, including the fact, this breaking news, the U.S. House just gave final approval for speedy action to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And that puts Congress on track, as the New York Times reports, to undo the most significant health care law in half a century. They still have, however, no plan to replace it. We talked about it quite a bit on yesterday's show. The Republicans don't know how to replace it, and they're going to face the fact that they're going to kick some 20 million Americans off of health insurance unless they come up with a better idea. In the meantime, the New York Press notes in their New York Times notes in their report this sentence: Republicans have repeatedly pledged to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Now they say they are intent on keeping their promise to Americans who have been crushed by soaring premiums and other intended effects of the law. Now, some premiums have gone up. How much it had to do with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare is unclear, unknown, and perhaps not related at all to the fact that, you know, these are people who had many millions of which had no health care coverage at all before. So the fact that New York Times sort of passes on that comment uncritically, that they have been crushed by soaring premiums and that it is an effect of the law, this kind of underscores, frankly, my decade-long plus problem that I have with the U.S. media and their failure to get facts right. Along those lines, we're going to be talking about the press here shortly with my guest, but getting facts right is important to me, so I want to do this correction. Yesterday, in my interview with First Amendment champion and Hustler magazine publisher Larry Flint, I misreported that Oliver Stone directed the film The People versus Larry Flint. My thanks to our friend D.R. Tucker for tweeting in today that it was actually Milos Forman who directed that award-winning film. In fact, Forman won the Golden Globe Award for directing the that 1996 film with Woody Harrelson as Larry Flint. And as Flint told me yesterday, playing him better than he plays himself. So you can see bradblog.com for that interview. My apologies for that error. Wanted to put that up front. We put our corrections up front whenever possible. We'll also, by the way, later on in the show, if we have time, I hope we do, a literal cover-up by Trump's inauguration team. We'll have the evidence for that later, and frankly, it stinks. Okay. Before I get to my guest here, I want to point out this piece from John Broich, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's an historian, an associate professor at Case Western University. I've been trying to get him on the program, haven't been able to so far. But he wrote a piece about normalizing fascists. It starts this way: how to report on a fascist. How to cover the rise of a political leader who's left a paper trail of anti-constitutionalism, racism, and the encouragement of violence. Does the press take the position that its subject acts outside the norms of society, or does it take the position that someone who wins a fair election is, by definition, normal because his leadership reflects the will of the people? These are questions, Brioche notes, that confronted the U.S. press after the ascendance of fascist leaders in Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 1930s. And Broich, I'm not even sure how to pronounce his name, actually, this was published at originally at The Conversation. It was republished by Smithsonian Magazine. Under the headline "How Journalists Covered the Rise of Mussolini and Hitler," and the remarkably understated subheadline "Reports on the Rise of Fascism in Europe," was not the American media's finest hour. Neither is it the American media's finest hour now. Broich's report ends here, I want to read the last few paragraphs in this because he points to a lot of, frankly, startling parallels between the way Mussolini, the rise and election of Mussolini was covered, the rise and election of Hitler was covered, and the way the U.S. media, going back to, you know, a lot of papers that are still around, the New Yorker, New York Times, and so forth, a lot of Washington Post, the way they covered Hitler's rise. And he didn't even need to compare it to the way the U.S. media is covering Trump now, because it kind of speaks for itself. The last few paragraphs here I want to read to you. He writes, journalists at the time were aware that they could only criticize the German regime so much and still maintain their access to it. When a CBS broadcaster's son was beaten up by Hitler's brown shirts for not saluting the Führer, he didn't report it. When the Chicago Daily News' Edgar Moyer wrote that Germany was becoming, quote, an insane asylum in 1933, the Germans pressured the State Department to rein in American reporters. Alan Dulles, who eventually became the director of the CIA, told Moyer he was, quote, taking the German situation too seriously. Moyer's publisher then transferred him out of Germany in fear of his life. By the later 1930s, most journalists realize their mistake in underestimating Hitler or failing to imagine just how bad things could get. Dorothy Thompson, who, as New York Post's Berlin bureau chief at the time, judged Hitler a man of, quote, startling insignificance in 1928. But she realized her mistake by mid-decade when she, like Moyer, began raising the alarm. No people ever recognize their dictator in advance, she reflected. In 1935, he never stands for election on the platform of dictatorship. He always represents himself as the instrument of the incorporated national will. Applying the lesson to the U.S., she wrote at the time, when our dictator turns up, you can depend on it that he will be one of the boys, and he will stand for everything traditionally American. Somewhat chilling. You can check out that full report at SmithsonianMag.com, or just look up normalizing fascists, although you might get a whole bunch of hits at this rate with that search. In any event, it raises a lot of questions and suggests that the media have not learned a whole hell of a lot. And with the press conference that took place on Wednesday, Donald Trump's press conference, bizarre, insane press conference, it raises the question of whether they have learned anything at all, or if we are in for a lot of the same that we have seen in the past. Not just in the past in the Bush years, but in the past in the Mussolini and Hitler years, perhaps. I'm going to talk about that and much more with my guest and media critic Matt Gaertz. Right after this, I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We haven't had much time this week with everything else that has been going on to talk specifically about the insane, bizarre, embarrassing press conference that Donald Trump held on Wednesday, his first in, I believe, something like 167 days. It came just the day after CNN had broke the news that the U.S. intelligence chiefs who had briefed Donald Trump last Friday, we are told, with evidence that evidence of Russia meddling in the U.S. election, that those intelligence chiefs had also warned him about this document from a former British intelligence agent charging that Russia had compromising personal and financial information, including allegedly lurid video, against Donald Trump. Now, the documents that the intel chiefs reportedly briefed Trump about, that is still an unsubstantiated report said to be from a former British MI6 agent, originally said to have been commissioned by the Jeb Bush campaign last year. But this report has been floating around, largely unreported by media outlets for months because they were unable to substantiate it. And then the documents, the full 35-page document that you've probably seen, certainly heard about by now, was released in full by BuzzFeed News after CNN's story broke on Tuesday night and before the press conference on Wednesday. Now, it likely would have been a crazy press conference anyway, But it certainly got even crazier in the wake of all of this after Trump called out CNN and BuzzFeed News as both fake news outlets. Here was the exchange when CNN's Jim Acosta tried, and to his credit, tried mightily to ask Trump about the charges.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? No, Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can you state, Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically,
she's asking a question.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody? No, Mr. President-elect, that's not appropriate.
Our fake news, says the president-elect to CNN's correspondent Jim Acosta there at that press conference, and you heard the applause thereafter. Writing at Media Matters, senior fellow Matt Gaetz noted in response to the entire news conference that Wednesday's press conference laid bare President-elect Donald Trump's strategy for dealing with the press as president. He will seek to delegitimize news outlets that provide critical coverage, try to turn them against one another, reward sycophantic coverage from openly pro-Trump sources, and encourage others to follow in their lead. In one day, Gaetz writes, we saw Trump publicly punish members of the press for critical reporting, threaten one outlet with consequences, quote, consequences for its actions, and calling on another to apologize. He thanked members of the press who behaved in a way that he found appropriate, and he took a question from an outlet tied to his top aide about what reforms he wanted to see from the press. We saw Trump aides publicly humiliate and jeer at reporters. We saw one news outlet respond to Trump's criticism by throwing another under the bus. We saw journalists treat the attacks on the press as a sideshow while praising Trump's performance, and we saw a U.S. congressman call for a reporter's firing for being, quote, disrespectful to the president-elect. Other than that, it was a totally normal news conference. Joining us now to talk about the specifics and what all of this means and what, if any, responsibility the media have in all of this and exactly what we are looking down the barrel of over the next 1, 2, 4, 8 years is Matt Gaetz of Media Matters for America. He's a senior fellow there, and he served as the organization's research director during the 2016 election. Matt Gaetz, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Happy to have you here. Okay, so this press conference was insane. We could have expected that. We did see that coming down the road. But I want to look at some of the specific concerns you had and then talk specifically about some of the media's responsibility in all of this. Because as much as you guys are certainly critical, deservedly so, of Trump in this case, Media Matters also spends a lot of time being critical of the media, of the U.S. corporate media. And so I want to talk about what, you know, responsibility they bear in this. But let's go through this a little bit. Before Trump even took the stage, you note in your article, both Sean Spicer, who will be the White House press secretary, and Vice President-elect Mike Pence, they already started punching media in the face before Trump even got there.
Yeah, I think that's important to realize, that this was not something that came out of nowhere. It's not like all of a sudden Donald Trump was attacking CNN. This was clearly the strategy going into the press conference, to attack BuzzFeed, to attack CNN, to tie the two of them together, and to suggest that all of their reporting was illegitimate, and to use that as a cudgel to present the rest of the media as being similarly biased in some way, or at least to raise that fear among Trump supporters. They went into this knowing that they had built up this very strong relationship with their supporters by doing this, by attacking the media over and over again at every event that Trump would do. You know, he would point back to the reporters who were crowded into a press pen, and he would attack them and say that they were disgusting and say that they were animals and call them out by name. And that created actually a very dangerous situation for some of those reporters. You know, you have cases of some of them needing to be escorted to their cars by the Secret Service, some of them, you know, taking video of like swastikas being waved at them while they were trying to work. I mean, this was sort of what Trump fed on during the election. And now I think we're seeing they're not going to stop with that. It's not like that was campaign Trump and there's going to be a new President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to go on trying to delegitimize the media one by one, piece by piece, to make it impossible for anyone to try to get out critical news and analysis about what his administration is doing. This was the first step, and it's going to keep getting worse.
And I think it's important that you note it was a group effort. It wasn't just Trump going off the reservation, that this happened before he even got there with his spokesperson and his vice president. He did, once Trump came up, he did thank the members of the media who, quote, came out so strongly against that fake news and the fact that it was written about by primarily one group and one television station. So who do you have any idea who he was talking to there? Was this a part of his strategy to turn them all against each other? I know the New York Times came out quite strongly by saying after CNN's report saying that these reports are unsubstantiated, that they've been known about for many months by journalists and politicians, but they are unsubstantiated. Do you get a sense? And they are correct. They are currently unsubstantiated, and those charges include some errors and so forth. Is that who he was talking about there, New York Times? And was that part of the strategy to turn the media against each other?
I think that's definitely the strategy. There are two things really happening here. One, Trump and his entire sort of circle has been desperately trying to tie together the CNN report, which is very, very strong, with what BuzzFeed did. So what CNN did is they reported based on several different sources, which were subsequently corroborated by other news sources, mm-hmm. that these top intelligence officials gave this briefing to President Obama, to Trump, which indicated that there are Russian operatives who claim to have this compromising personal and financial information about Trump, and that Trump's sort of allies were in constant communication mm-hmm. with the Russians during the election.
To be clear, so, they didn't report, CNN did not report these things were true. They were reporting that the intelligence chiefs told Trump that this report exists, whether it's true or not, correct?
Correct. And so really the news behind that was that the intelligence chiefs believed that this was an important enough piece of information, that it was, that they believed that it was credible enough, some parts of it at least, to present. Now, what they ended up presenting was a two-page synthesis mm-hmm. of these 35 pages of memos from a former British intelligence officer. We don't know which parts of those 35 pages of memos mm-hmm. That the intelligence community believes are credible. We know that it's been reported that they believe that the intelligence officer himself has a very good reputation, but, you know, this is, he's dealing in raw intelligence, so some of it could be true, some of it could be not true, and we don't really know how the intelligence community has come down on particular parts of it. So what CNN did there was some fairly substantial journalism that basically what they proved was this information was conveyed to the highest levels, and that suggests that there's some credibility to some of it. What BuzzFeed did was quite different. What BuzzFeed did was they took all of the memos and said, we've been trying to investigate and corroborate these memos for months. We haven't been able to do so, but now CNN is discussing them, you know, publicly. They clearly have been sort of conveyed to the top levels of U.S. Mm-hmm. Journalism and politicians, and therefore we're just going to publish them all and let the audience sort of decide what they think of them. There were very different strategies and ways of handling this story. And there was a lot of criticism of what BuzzFeed did because they hadn't corroborated the information.
What's your thoughts on that, Matt? Were they right to release that information? Because the argument, at least as I see it from a journalistic point of view, is that the news here was initially that CNN, was able to accurately, apparently, report that the intelligence chiefs had explained this 35-page document in some fashion to Donald Trump. And then rather than speculating about it, BuzzFeed said, here is the document. We can't tell you, we can't corroborate this, but here is the document that Trump was briefed on. So were they correct? And it had salacious, explosive allegations, all unsubstantiated in them. But were they right to release that material to the public as you see it?
I'm going to be entirely honest here. I go back and forth on this quite a lot. Obviously, you want journalists to be verifying the information that they lay out. On the other hand, this is a document that is circulating at the highest levels of government that every journalist in town seems to have seen. The only people that haven't seen it are the American public. So at that point, you have to question whether there is some value in people being able to see a document like that. I think that it's a tough call. I've seen some commentators be very critical of that decision. I've seen others say, look, in national security journalism, often what you're doing is hoping that your sources are right anyway, so and hoping that they're not playing you, and you can't really verify a lot of what's going on anyway. So, how does this necessarily differ from that? Well, I think it's a complicated question,
yeah.
And I think that it's the question that, Donald Trump would prefer us to spend a lot of time on, because the more time we're spending sort of discussing the journalistic ethics and implications of it, the less time we're spending dealing with the fact that the top people in the U.S. intelligence community are giving this giving portions of this document to the President of the United States and the President-elect with making these very very serious allegations.
Let's not please Donald Trump. Let's not for the moment then talk about that aspect and go back to the, because I go back and forth on it as well. I've been critical, frankly, of a lot of the reporting on the entire Russian situation that, the media has been happy to report the conclusions, but they haven't actually shared evidence. And not on these salacious claims, but on the other claims, the hacking and so forth. And I don't believe the media has been nearly as tough on the officials, frankly, who are leaking this material without giving us evidence to support it. But let me put that aside for the moment, unless you have some thoughts, because I want to look at, I thought Acosta did a great job in trying, at least, to get in a response to Donald Trump in that audio that we played at the top. But you argue that the press did nothing in response to Trump's attack on Acosta. What should the press have done at that point? And doesn't that seem to speak to their failure as opposed to Trump's in this case, that they didn't do it? They didn't take action.
I think it definitely does speak to their failure. Back in January, Donald Trump bragged on the campaign trail that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and he could shoot somebody and he wouldn't lose voters. And, rhetorically speaking, that's basically what he did to Jim Acosta. He basically took him out in front of the entire press corps, humiliated him pretty brutally, and then sort of went about his business, and other reporters just sort of moved along, and they would, and they went on, and they asked their questions, and they just sort of kept going. They could have refused to ask any questions until, basically demanded that CNN get an opportunity to speak. They could have pushed back against Trump attacking a media outlet, asking him straight up, well, what do you think it says about your commitment to the First Amendment that you are lashing out at CNN as fake news in your first press conference, as president-elect? I mean, that just seems wildly inappropriate.
So they could have taken
that position. It's tricky, right? Because they need to be able to take collective action without playing into everything that Trump has been saying about how the press is out to get him.
You're right. They could have. They could have taken the opportunity, you're right, to say, why shouldn't Jim Acosta be able to ask you a question? Why? But had they done that, Matt Gaetz, They had who I'm going to sort of call Donald Trump's Jeff Gannon at this point. They turned to Matt Boyle of Breitbart.com. You report that he was the only reporter, and I'm putting the word reporter in air quotes at this point. Matt Boyle, he was the only one. He was the only one who had a seat reserved in the front, in the center. I've had some experience with this clown Matt Boyle over the years. I suspect you have too. Do you want to tell us who Matt Boyle is?
Matt Boyle is a reporter, and I think air quotes are appropriate here, for Breitbart.com.
Yeah.
Breitbart is, of course, the conservative website that is run by Stephen Bannon, who is going to be Trump's like top aide in the White House. So it's basically a house organ for it was basically a house organ for the Trump campaign.
Mm-hmm.
During the campaign, staff there reportedly believed that their coverage was so funny that they must have been getting money from him. Nobody knows if that's true or not. But certainly, if it isn't, like,
well,
you can't really tell the difference between whether or not what a Breitbart that had received money from Donald Trump would look like and what the Breitbart that we have looks like. Boyle himself is an incredibly sycophantic character who clearly is a huge fan of Donald Trump, was at times during the campaign openly bragging about the job that he was going to get in Trump's White House, which is a very strange thing for a reporter to do. You know, he is, you know, clearly more or less an advocate, not a journalist. And so the question that he goes and asks, given the opportunity, is not, you know, a serious question about Trump's policies or history or whatever, but it's the decision to publish fake news and all the problems that we've seen throughout the media over the course of the election, what reforms do you recommend for this industry here? So he's basically taking Trump's side against the assembled press, saying BuzzFeed and CNN published fake news, and asking for Trump to like come up with ways to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and asking what are going to be your reforms for the media, and I want to talk about. I'm speaking with Matt Gaertz, senior fellow at Media Matters, about this press conference on Wednesday. This insane press conference. Matt Boyle, I should note, he was actually let go from Tucker Carlson's Daily Caller some years ago. For terrible reporting, getting it wrong, and a whole bunch of stories. Just to give you some idea, he wasn't even good enough for Tucker Carlson at that point. It reminds me of, as I mentioned, Jeff Gannon. Do you remember him, Matt Gaertz?
I do,
from
yeah.
The Bush years? So Donald Trump was able to turn, even if the media had all stuck together, it seems like he's got his own people. He's got his own plants that he can rely on. Like a Jeff Gannon. Do you want to remind us who Jeff Gannon is, if you can reach back that far to the Bush years?
Jeff Gannon was a reporter for a news outlet that was called Talon News. This was back in 2004 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he was basically the lifeline in the White House press corps. Anytime Artie Fleischer would get into trouble, or I think Scott McClellan possibly at the time, would get into trouble with some sort of difficult question, they'd call on this guy, Scott Gannon. And, you know, for a while, everyone was really confused about why there was this person writing for this outlet that no one had ever heard of, who was in the, you know, in the White House, you know, getting questions answered by the White House press secretary. And it turns out, if I recall correctly, that was not his real name.
Yeah, no, it was.
His name, his real name, it was Guckert, I think, was his actual name.
Yeah.
And there were some, I believe there were some salacious details about his previous employment.
For an escort service or something like that at the time. Yeah, nobody had known where this guy came from, and we still really don't. It was sort of clearly a plant.
And he sort of dropped off the map after all of that went public. I think this is what we're going to see going forward. There's going to be a couple of different categories of journalists that Trump deals with. There's going to be the total sycophant plants, people like people like Matt Boyle and Breitbart. There's this other outlet called One America News Network, which mm-hmm. was also given the opportunity to ask a question during this press conference. There's this web outfit called Right Side Broadcasting Network, which mm-hmm. has been called the unofficial version of Trump TV. They're going to start being in the White House press briefings. I mean, you know, we could see some really the White House Press Association has pretty lax rules on who they let in, and I think that's good. I mean, I think you should have news outlets of all types should have access to the White House and public officials. But I think we're going to see people like Alex Jones take on an increasingly powerful role in American public life. Alex Jones is, of course, a crazy conspiracy theorist who, you know, thinks that the government is behind basically everything.
And we're
going to see Trump lift these people up and give them access mm-hmm. And deny access to people who produce more critical reporting.
And that was, when we were talking about Matt Boyle and his question, you know, how should all of this be? What reforms do we need for the media? Trump responded he didn't support reforms, just reporters who have some moral compass. I guess he was talking about guys like Sean Hannity at Fox News. He had Rudy Giuliani on, who I think has also now been given some sort of role in the Trump administration or the Trump transition. Here was their exchange about this press conference and about the way Trump went after CNN's Jim Acosta. They were just giddy about it.
I thought this was a pretty big beatdown for the whole country to see yesterday.
This was a great thing that he did. It is refreshing. And it is very good for our democracy that we have a president that is trying to get us back to a free press.
Is this indicative of what's going to happen the next 4 to 8 years?
Yeah, but I think he's going to win this battle. He's an honest man, so they're not going to catch him in some kind of lie or something like that. And he's got the courage to fight him back. Yeah. And the American people have caught on to it. So I think that this is going to be very helpful. I think maybe he may actually reestablish journalistic ethics. You know?
A big beatdown for the country to see. That's a good thing. To get us back to a free press by shutting them down, this will be helpful. Matt Gaertz, your article is appropriately headlined, "In One Day, 17 Signs of How Bad Press Treatment Will Be Under Trump." I see no sign that the media actually understand what they are now up against with the Donald Trump administration. You write that in the Washington Post, they reported that Trump had, quote, a decent press conference in which they, quote, remarkably, he offered kind words for news organizations. A decent press conference? And Politico, by the way, was no better. For most people who watched Trump yesterday, you write, it was a pretty good, or they write, it was a pretty good performance. A good performance, a decent press conference, Matt Gaertz. I don't think the media have learned much of anything yet at this point. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that clip that you just played is very appropriate and kind of gives the game away. I am a progressive media critic. Progressive media critics generally think that the media does some things wrong, and when they do things that are wrong, they should be corrected, and that there are some structural impediments to getting good news coverage in this country. Conservative media criticism says that reporters are terrible people who should be destroyed, unless they can be sort of bent to the will of people like Donald Trump. I mean, that is effectively what Newt Gingrich was saying there. Or, sorry, what Rudy Giuliani was saying there.
Yeah.
I mentioned Newt Gingrich because Newt Gingrich went on Hannity's show the night before and said, you don't have to think of the New York Times or CNN or any of these people as news organizations. They're mostly propaganda organizations. And he suggested that rather than taking these questions from these adversarial reporters, Trump start flying in reporters from out of town who will be more courteous and responsible. So, I mean, that's really what's going on here.
Paging Jeff Gannon again. Fly him
these
in.
These are your options. Yes. You can either get on board and you can be like Matt Boyle, and you can be a good reporter who just stays in your lane and lets Trump walk all over you, or you can be Jim Acosta and you can be crushed on national television in front of millions of people.
Now,
those are the options available.
Now, not to blame the victim here in this case, but how much of this is brought on by the media themselves, either by their own bad reporting, and there has been a lot of it, or otherwise being docile, you know, and compliant, and not just during the past year, during the 2016 presidential campaign, but frankly, for so many years prior. And you guys have documented a lot of this over the past at MediaMatters.org, you know, over the past two administrations. It was particularly bad, I should say, during the Bush era. You know, so how much of this are they just to blame for themselves because they have not stood up in all of this time? They have proven that they can be sort of pushed around by thugs and nobody will do anything about it.
Well, I think they need to figure out a way to do something about it pretty fast. I mean, they have tools and weapons at their disposal that they've used before. They were happy during the Obama administration to push back when, you know, things like photographers weren't given enough access to White House events, or there's this one instance where a Fox pooler didn't get access to an interview session in Treasury, and the rest of the press rose up together and said, "This is inappropriate. We won't allow it. This must stop." And the Obama administration basically caved to that pretty quickly. Now, I don't know if the Trump administration is as likely to respond to that. My guess is that they are not, because they honestly don't care about the role of the free press and are not really worried if journalists are mad at them, or if, you know, the role of the media in U.S. society is curtailed in some way. But they have to try, right? That's really all they can do at this point, because what's going to happen at some point is you're going to see, and, you know, Gingrich is already suggesting this. You know, he suggested with Acosta, you know, give him a 60-day ban. He's not allowed in any Trump events for the next 60 days, you know, because he was a bad boy.
Wow.
He gets punished.
Wow.
And, you know, that's going to happen eventually. So the Trump campaign did this all the time. They banned the Des Moines Register because the editorial board came out against Donald Trump. They kicked New York Times reporters out of events. They banned several news outlets from reporting altogether on the campaign. This is what they do, and there's no reason to think that they won't do it while Donald Trump is president, and then the press is going to have to make a call. They're going to have to make a call. Are they going to do something about it together, or are they just going to let it happen, roll over, and wait for it to happen to them next?
Do you see any signs they are going to do anything about it, Matt?
I don't know. It doesn't look good right now. It doesn't look good after that press conference. You know, we're going to keep shouting and hope that they realize that they have to do something, because, you know, we need a free press that's strong and willing to push back right now. And we're not getting it.
We do. I was speaking with your fellow at Media Matters, Eric Bollert, some weeks ago, and I suggested that, hey, maybe this is all good. Maybe if all of these reporters lose their access, you know, if Jim Acosta is kicked out for 6 months or whatever Gingrich suggested, maybe if they lose their access, they'll actually have to go out and do some actual reporting instead of just sitting around and waiting to repeat what high-level sources want them to repeat. Is that a possible upside, or am I just looking for anything at this point, Matt?
I mean, I think that could happen. You know, we saw certainly during the campaign, we saw outlets that were banned still continue to do good reporting without that level of access.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question is really, you know, if CNN reporters get banned from covering the White House, is CNN still going to, you know, do live coverage of Trump events?
Hey,
that's the real question. Because certainly Trump is not going to turn the cameras away. He may turn the reporters away, but he will certainly not turn away the opportunity to be on camera. So are they going to use that as leverage to say, you cannot do this, or else we will stop covering your events. They didn't do that. They wouldn't do that, you know, sort of in solidarity for one another during the campaign. We'll see what happens if they still take those live feeds now that he's going to be president.
Well, hey, arguably during the campaign, you could do it. You could pick and choose who you covered, which candidates you covered. But now he will be the president of the United States. And when the president of the United States speaks, that's news. And, I don't even know how they would justify saying, well, we're not going to cover it at this point. But I think there's a lot that we don't know that we'll find out. Trump, as you write at the end of your article, will be sworn in as president in 8 days. And you warn things can still get much, much worse. I'm afraid you're right. Matt Gaetz, really appreciate you joining us here today. Hope you'll come back in the future. Matt Gaetz, senior fellow at Media Matters for America. You can find them and his work at mediamatters.org. And on the Twitters at simply Matt Gaetz. Really appreciate you joining us today, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. All right, a quick break, and we're back with the Green News Report and an actual cover-up discovered at the presidential inauguration coming up next week. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, Desi Doyen, we should get to our Green News Report here.
Yes.
Because I've got some news thereafter on a cover-up at the presidential inauguration. So let's get to it, right?
Yes.
Our latest Green News Report.
The science behind the clear connection is not conclusive.
ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson gets a grilling on climate change during Senate confirmation hearings. Court orders Exxon to comply with AG's investigation into climate science denial. 6 Volkswagen executives indicted in emissions cheating scandal. Plus,
in just 8 years, we've halved our dependence on foreign oil. We've doubled our renewable energy. We've led the world to an agreement that has the promise to save this planet.
President Obama appeals to reason on climate in his farewell address.
All of that appealing reason and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Our children won't have time to debate the existence of climate change. They'll be busy dealing with its effects.
Actually, they may be busy sacrificing their firstborn to Empress Ivanka. Thanks, Obama. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, a protester at the Rex Tillerson confirmation hearings, I think might have had the most succinct expression of this moment.
Please don't put Exxon in charge of the State Department. Protect our children and grandchildren.
Exxon is about to be in charge of the State Department.
Yeah, it sure does look like that could be the case. On the first day of his Senate confirmation hearing to be the next Secretary of State, the CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, on Wednesday responded to pointed questions from Democratic senators about his beliefs on climate science and policy with a subtle level of denial. Unlike President-elect Donald Trump, Tillerson says he accepts climate change is occurring, but he said the science was, quote, not conclusive whether it's man-made, and downplayed the global scientific consensus.
The risk of climate change does exist. The consequences of it could be serious enough that action should be taken. The type of action seems to be where the largest areas of debate exist in the public discourse. The increase in the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere are having an effect. Our ability to predict that effect is very limited.
Oh, well, it's happening, but we can't predict what it's going to cause, so let's just not do anything about it.
Yeah, except the predictions of climate scientists are already coming true earlier than predicted. The Pentagon and the intelligence community have warned that climate change is a major threat to national security and international stability. But to acknowledge that climate change is man-made would require Tillerson to acknowledge Exxon's role in causing it.
And of course, Exxon itself does acknowledge climate change, but they're incredibly vague about it.
Yeah, and speaking to that, Democratic senator and former vice presidential candidate candidate Tim Kaine of Virginia politely grilled Tillerson about reports that Exxon's own scientists confirmed man-made climate change back in the 1970s, but that the company instead misled the public and its investors for decades and paid millions to fund climate denial propaganda outlets.
I'm asking you whether those allegations are true or false.
The question would be have to be put to ExxonMobil.
And let me ask you, do you lack the knowledge to answer my question, or are you refusing to answer my question?
A little of both.
Yeah, a little of both, because his company is facing some very serious investigations on this front.
Yep, on the same day, Exxon lost its latest court battle to block the investigation undertaken right now by Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. The court ordered ExxonMobil to comply in turning over 40 years' worth of the company's internal documents on climate change. She's investigating whether Exxon misled its investors, a violation of state law.
So you already have this conflict of interest. You've got Rex Tillerson asked a question about his own company in this hearing for his potential appointment as Secretary of State, and he can't even talk about Exxon. I think that's just a taste of the conflicts of interest we're going to see from this administration for years.
Meanwhile, in other news, Volkswagen on Wednesday pled guilty to three criminal charges for intentionally rigging its cars to cheat on U.S. emissions regulations. Six high-ranking executives were also indicted on criminal charges for their roles in the scandal. The German carmaker will pay $4.3 billion in civil and criminal penalties, including violations of the Clean Air Act. Finally, President Obama used his farewell address as president on Tuesday night to remind Americans of the progress that the nation has already made on climate and clean energy, and to give one last call to rise above the deniers.
To simply deny the problem not only betrays future generations, it betrays the essential spirit of this country, the essential spirit of innovation and practical problem solving that guided our founders.
Yeah, maybe so, but denial makes a whole lot more money for the fossil fuel industries. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Thanks for all the lovely delight I found in your embrace. I'm thankful, though I know it's ending all too soon.
Yes, yes it is.
Yeah.
At least for the planet, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I think for all of us.
Well,
all of us alive on planet Earth,
well,
yes,
yeah,
it's
guess,
a problem.
Yeah. If you compare one president to the incoming, yes, I guess it is definitely a problem. Okay. Well, let me two quick stories here before we go. One, the head of the D.C. National Guard, Major General Errol Schwartz, said on Friday that he has been ordered removed from his command effective January 20 at 12:01 p.m., just as Donald Trump is sworn in as president. Schwartz's forced departure comes amidst the presidential inauguration that he has spent months helping plan alongside the D.C. police, the U.S. Secret Service, and other top district officials. He'll turn over command to an interim in power as power transfers from one president to the next and just before the inaugural parade marches down Pennsylvania Avenue. The timing is extremely unusual, says Schwartz in an interview on Friday, confirming a memo announcing his ouster that was obtained by the Washington Post. During the inauguration, Schwartz would command not only the members of the D.C. Guard, but also an additional 5,000 unarmed troops that are sent in from across the country to help. He would oversee military air support as well, protecting the nation's capital during the inauguration. So he says he would oversee duties in a command center and then depart at 12:01 p.m., retiring from the Army. Just dismissed like that by Donald Trump. He has no idea why. He has not been told why he was asked to step down. But he says, I'm a soldier. I'm a presidential appointee. Therefore, the president has the power to remove me. He says he's following orders. He has no regrets.
Well, you know, Trump does seem to prefer people who don't have any experience, so get rid of the guy who's done it for the last several decades.
Yeah, he has started his military career in 1976 by enlisting in the Guard. He's the head of the D.C. National Guard, at least until Friday at 12:01 p.m., and he's being told to take a hike. Okay, other than that, this cover-up has been revealed by AP. Workers preparing for the inauguration on January 20 have taped over the name of the company that has long supplied portable restrooms for major outdoor events in the nation's capital. The Virginia-based company calls itself the Washington area's top provider of portable toilet rentals, but the name apparently strikes too close to home for inaugural organizers. The name of the company? Don's Johns. Workers have placed blue tape over the company name on dozens of portable restrooms and being installed near the Capitol for the inauguration. The company's name is clearly visible upon close inspection, but it's blocked for a wide-angle view by a TV or a still camera. Robert Weghorst, the chief operating officer for Don's Johns, said he didn't know that the logos were covered up until the AP reported on it, lighting up his company's switchboard and blowing up its social media accounts. He says, "We don't know why it's being done. We didn't tell someone to do it." He said, "We're very proud to have our names on the units."
And Don Trump is not interested.
No, apparently they need to cover that up. That's how sensitive they are. Or at least somebody is. Don's Johns has provided portable toilets for many large events in Washington, including the 2009 and 2013 inauguration ceremonies for Barack Obama. According to Weghorst, no logos were taped over during those events, he said. Sensitive much, Donnie? My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, Matt Gertz from MediaMatters.org. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it anytime you like for free at bradblog.com. They're all there. They're all also over at iTunes and other fine podcasting sites. We hope you'll put in a good review for us at all of those places to make it a little bit easier for everyone else to find us. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can find, follow, share us, and everything else you'd like to do to us on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.